Good morning. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading again from a Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold. To start with, I'll be reading from the March chapter, The Geese Return. One swallow does not make a summer, but one skein of geese cleaving the murk of a March thaw is the spring. The cardinal, whistling spring to a thaw, but later finding himself mistaken, can retrieve his error by resuming his winter silence. A chipmunk, emerging for a sunbath but finding a blizzard, has only to go back to bed. But a migrating goose, staking 200 miles of black night on the chance of finding a hole in the lake, has no easy chance for retreat. His arrival carries the conviction of a prophet who has burned his bridges. A March morning is only as drab as he who walks in it without a glance skyward, ear-cocked for geese. I once knew an educated lady, banded by Phi Beta Kappa, who told me that she had never heard or seen the geese that twice a year proclaim the revolving seasons to her well-insulated roof. Is education possibly a process of trading awareness for things of lesser worth? The goose who trades his is soon a pile of feathers. The geese that proclaim the seasons to our farm are aware of many things, including the Wisconsin statutes. The southbound November flocks pass over us high and haughty, with scarcely a honk of recognition for their favorite sandbars and sloughs. As a crow flies is crooked compared with their undeviating aim at the nearest big lake 20 miles to the south, where they loaf by day on broad waters and filch corn by night from the freshly cut stubbles. November geese are aware that every marsh and pond bristles from dawn till dark with hopeful guns. March geese are a different story. Although they've been shot at most of the winter, as attested by their buckshot battered pinions, they know that the spring truce is now in effect. They wind the oxbows of the river, cutting low over the now gunless points and islands, and gabbling to each sandbar as to a long-lost friend. They weave low over the marshes and meadows, greeting each newly melted puddle and pool. Finally, after a few pro forma circlings of our marsh, they set wing and glide silently to the pond, black landing gear lowered and rumps white against the far hill. Once touching water, our newly arrived guests set up a honking and splashing that shakes the last thought of winter out of the brittle cattails. Our geese are home again. It is at this moment of each year that I wish I were a muskrat, eye deep in the marsh. Once the first geese are in, they honk a clamorous invitation to each migrating flock, and in a few days the marsh is full of them. On our farm, we measure the amplitude of our spring by 2 yardsticks, the number of pines planted and the number of geese that stop. A record of 642 geese counted in on 11 April 1946. As in fall, our spring geese make daily trips to corn, but these are no surreptitious sneakings out by night. The flocks move noisily to and from corn stubbles through the day. Each departure is preceded by loud, gustatory debate, and each return by an even louder one. The returning flocks, once thoroughly at home, omit their pro forma circlings of the marsh. They rumble out of the sky like maple leaves, side-slipping right and left to lose altitude, feet spraddled toward the shouts of welcome below. I suppose the ensuing gabble deals with the merits of the day's dinner. They are now eating the waste corn that the snow blanket has protected over winter from corn-seeking crows, cottontails, meadow mice, and pheasants. It is a conspicuous fact that the corn stubbles selected by geese for feeding are usually those occupying former prairies. No man knows whether this bias for prairie corn reflects some superior nutritional value or some ancestral tradition transmitted from generation to generation since the prairie days. Perhaps it reflects the simpler fact that prairie cornfields tend to be large. If I could understand the thunderous debates that precede and follow these daily excursions to corn, I might soon learn the reason for the prairie bias. But I cannot, and I'm well content that it should remain a mystery. What a dull world if we knew all about geese. In thus watching the daily routine of a spring goose convention, one notices the prevalence of singles, lone geese that do much flying about and much talking. One is apt to impute a disconsolate tone to their honkings and to jump to the conclusion that they are broken-hearted widowers or mothers hunting lost children. The seasoned ornithologist knows, however, that such subjective interpretation of bird behavior is risky. I long tried to keep an open mind on the question. After my students and I had counted for half a dozen years the number of geese comprising a flock, some unexpected light was cast on the meaning of lone geese. It was found by mathematical analysis that flocks of six or multiples of six were far more frequent than chance alone would dictate. In other words, goose flocks are families or aggregations of families, and lone geese in spring are probably just what our fond imaginings had first suggested. They are bereaved survivors of the winter shooting, searching in vain for their kin. Now I am free to grieve with and for the lone honkers. It is not often that cold potato mathematics thus confirms the sentimental promptings of the bird lover. On April nights, when it has become warm enough to sit outdoors, we love to listen to the proceedings of the convention in the marsh. There are long periods of silence when one hears only the winnowing of snipe, the hoot of a distant owl, or the nasal clucking of some amorous coot. Then, of a sudden, a strident honk resounds, and in an instant pandemonium echoes. There is a beating of pinions on water, a rushing of dark prows propelled by churning paddles, and a general shouting by the onlookers of a vehement controversy. Finally, some deep honker has his last word, and the noise subsides to that half-audible small talk that seldom ceases among geese. Once again, I would I were a muskrat. By the time the pasks are in full bloom, our goose convention dwindles, and before May our marsh is once again a mere grassy wetness, enlivened only by redwings and rails. It is an irony of history that the great powers should have discovered the unity of nations at Cairo in 1943. The geese of the world have had that notion for a longer time, and each March they stake their lives on its essential truth. In the beginning there was only the unity of the ice sheet. Then followed the unity of the March thaw and the northward hegira of the international geese. Every March since the Pleistocene, the geese have honked unity from China Sea to Siberian steppe, from Euphrates to Volga, from Nile to Murmansk, from Lincolnshire to Spitsbergen. Every March since the Pleistocene, the geese have honked unity from Currituck to Labrador, Mata Mesquite to Ungava, Horseshoe Lake to Hudson's Bay, Avery Island to Baffin Land, Panhandle to Mackenzie, Sacramento to Yukon. By this international commerce of geese, the waste corn of Illinois is carried through the clouds to the Arctic tundras, there to combine with the waste sunlight of a nightless June to grow goslings for all the lands between. And in this annual barter of food for light and winter warmth for summer solitude, the whole continent receives as net profit a wild poem dropped from the murky skies upon the muds of March. And now the April chapter starts. Come high water. The same logic that causes big rivers always to flow past big cities causes cheap farms sometimes to be marooned by spring floods. Ours is a cheap farm, and sometimes when we visit it in April, we get marooned. Not intentionally, of course, but one can, to a degree, guess from weather reports when the snows up north will melt, and one can estimate how many days it takes for the flood to run the gauntlet of upriver cities. Thus, come Sunday evening, one must go back to town and work, but one can't. How sweetly the spreading waters murmur condolence for the wreckage they have inflicted on Monday morning dates. How deep and chesty the honkings of the geese as they cruise over cornfield after cornfield, each in process of becoming a lake. Every 100 yards, some new goose flails the air as he struggles to lead the echelon in its morning survey of this new and watery world. The enthusiasm of geese for high water is a subtle thing and might be overlooked by those unfamiliar with goose gossip, but the enthusiasm of carp is obvious and unmistakable. No sooner has the rising flood wetted the grass roots than here they come, rooting and wallowing with the prodigious zest of pigs turned out to pasture, flashing red tails and yellow bellies, cruising the wagon tracks and cow paths, and shaking the reeds and bushes in their haste to explore what to them is an expanding universe. Unlike the geese and the carp, the terrestrial birds and mammals accept high water with philosophical detachment. The cardinal atop a river birch whistles loudly his claim to a territory that, but for the trees, cannot seem to exist. A rough grouse drums from the flooded woods. He must be perched on the high end of his highest drumming log. Meadow mice paddle ridgeward with the calm assurance of miniature muskrats. From the orchard bounds a deer, evicted from his usual daytime bed in the willow thickets. Everywhere are rabbits calmly accepting quarters on our hill, which serves, in Noah's absence, for an ark. The spring flood brings us more than high adventure. It brings likewise an unpredictable miscellany of floatable objects pilfered from upriver farms. An old board stranded on our meadow has to us twice the value of the same piece new from the lumberyard. Each old board has its own individual history, always unknown, but always to some degree guessable from the kind of wood, its dimensions, its nails, screws, or paint, its finish or lack of it, its wear or decay. One can even guess, from the abrasion of its edges and ends on sandbars, how many floods have carried it in years past. Our lumber pile, recruited entirely from the river, is thus not only a collection of personalities, but an anthology of human strivings in upriver farms and forests. The autobiography of an old board is a kind of literature not yet taught on campuses, but any riverbank farm is a library where he who hammers or saws may read at will. Come high water, there's always an accession of new books. There are degrees and kinds of solitude. An island in a lake has one kind, but lakes have boats, and there is always the chance that some might land to pay you a visit. A peak in the clouds has another kind, but most peaks have trails, and trails have tourists. I know of no solitude so secure as one guarded by a spring flood. Nor do the geese, who have seen more kinds and degrees of aloneness than I have. So we sit on our hill beside a new-blown pasque, and watch the geese go by. I see our road dipping gently into the waters, and I conclude, with inner glee but exterior detachment, that the question of traffic in or out is, for this day at least, debatable only among carp. And that's where I will stop reading the April chapter. Isn't this wonderful, being with Aldo Leopold? This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you so much for listening.